Well, here we are again, and let's continue where we left off. Now, during the Hegelian period, the NEA was more or less of a, you might say, a discussion club, run by the intellectual elite. They met once a year, and they had wonderful, gave wonderful speeches, and then departed, expressed their ideas. But then around the turn of the century arose an entirely new movement that basically materialistic. In other words, although the communists had departed from Hegelian idealism into dialectical materialism, so the progressives were a reflection of that new shift from idealism to progressivism. John Dewey came from a good Christian family in Vermont, went to the University of went to Johns Hopkins University, where he became a Hegelian. So he started out as an idealist, and then by the time he got to the University of Chicago, he was a materialist, and an atheist, and a socialist. But what was the progressive movement? Well, the progressives were a... let me read you the description I give in one of my talks to simplify things. They were a new breed of highly sophisticated educator, epitomized by John Dewey, trained in the new evolution-oriented humanist psychology developed in Germany by Wilhelm Wundt. Now, the interesting thing about psychology is that during the Calvinist period, theology was uppermost in people's minds, knowledge of God. During the Hegelian period, you began to have a gradual shift into knowledge of man, but the first form of psychology was known as phrenology. I don't know if you know anything about phrenology, but it was the idea that the brain is composed of certain areas that are that handle different aspects of our personality, and that they are overdeveloped in certain areas, we have a certain kind of personality. For example, if the part of the brain that is supposed to handle your combative nature, then if that's larger than your peaceful nature, then of course you're going to be a combative person. Phrenology, as you know, dealt with bumps on the head, and the whole idea of that if you were intelligent, if you had a high forehead, came from the phrenologist. But that was the first means to try to get a non-theological view of man, because once they departed from the biblical view of man as to the origin of his nature and of his fallen nature, they had to deal with man's evil. And so the phrenologists were the first to attribute man's evil to this uneven development in the brain. Bumps, larger bumps, smaller bumps, etc. But that wasn't very scientific, as you can imagine, because they could not really establish cause and effect. And so, Wilhelm Wundt in Germany in his laboratory decided to, since they by then all believed in evolution, and that was a very powerful force beginning now at this period, evolution. The rise of the theory of evolution in the 1870s and 80s had a tremendous impact on American intellectuals, the theory of evolution. And since they decided that man was not created by God, that he was a product of this primordial ooze or whatever, and that he was, his ancestors were, he had similar ancestors to the monkeys, that we all came from a similar background, but they decided now, well, why not study man the way we study animals? After all, if man is just another animal, why don't we begin to observe him the way we observe animals? So they began to have this clinical view of man. They call it clinical psychology, experimental psychology. And Wundt was the first psychologist, he began as a physiologist, but he was the first man in Germany to begin to study man as an animal, his behavior, his reactions, reaction time, his nervous system, and all of that. They began to scientifically study man so that they could know more about him. And of course, our intellectuals who were totally taken by evolution, Selfred, hook, line, and sinker. And so we had a good many of our educators going over to Germany and being trained by Hegel. And probably the most influential of them all, was G. Stanley Hall, who then became Jewish teacher, who went to Germany and became a Wundtian. Now, Hall came from the same background as Dewey, from good Christian New England families. As a matter of fact, they all did, all of these progressives. Men like Hall came from a family in New England. James McKean Patel came from a Presbyterian family in Pennsylvania. Dewey came from a Congregationalist family in Vermont. So these men knew the Bible. They knew they had a good Christian background, and yet they were completely taken by the Hegelian philosophy at first, and then they discarded that and went into materialism. And of course, psychology became everything to them. That became the new wave. That was the new view of man. Psychology, the application of the new psychology on every aspect of man's life. Now, let me just read to you a small section of a quote from G. Stanley Hall's own autobiography about what Germany did to him, his stay in Germany. He writes, "Germany almost remade me. I came home feeling that I had also attained maturity in my religious consciousness, where most suffer such dwarfing arrest. I had felt the charm of pantheism, which has inspired and exerted so much of its subtle influence, especially through the medium of poetry, in those whose creed abhors it. Of agnosticism, more or less common, but so strangled by religious affirmation. Of even materialism, for I had read Buchner and Moll Scott, and had wrestled with Karl Marx and half accepted what I understood of him, though Kant and the positivists had pretty much made out their case, and that the theological, if not the metaphysical, stage of thought should be transcended. But the only wholehearted scheme of things which I had accepted with ardor and abandon was that of an evolution which applied no whit less to the soul than the body of man. This was dead rock. Darwin, Haeckel, and especially Herbert Spencer seemed then to me to represent the most advanced stage of human thought." Unquote. So you can see how what evolution did to the minds of these men. They were absolutely taken by it. This is on 45 of my book. And then Hall writes on his return to the United States, he writes that he returned to the United States in 1871 in full revolt against his Puritan upbringing. He writes, "I fairly loathed and hated so much that I saw about me that I now realize more clearly than ever how possible it would have been for me to have drifted into some, perhaps almost any camp of radicals, and to have come into such open rupture with the scheme of things as they were that I should have been stigmatized as dangerous, at least for any academic career where the motto was safety first. And as this was the only way left open, the alternative being the dread one of going back to the farm, it was most fortunate that these deeply stirred instincts of revolt were never openly expressed, and my rank heresies and socialistic leanings unknown." Unquote. So there you have G. Stanley Hall, totally taken in by evolution. You have Hall. Dewey didn't go to Europe. He didn't study under Wundt, but he was greatly influenced by Wundt and by the others. James McKean Cattell. He was the Presbyterian. He studied under Wundt. He was the first American to study. Oh, he was Wundt's assistant. He got his Hall got his I think the first American to get a PhD from Wundt, Doctor of Psychology, and Cattell was Wundt's first American assistant. Cattell was actually at that time even experimenting with hallucinogenic drugs. They were doing it way before anyone else was doing it. And Cattell tried everything. There's a marvelous edition of his diary out of his years in Wundt's laboratory. And it's interesting to see the drift away from the faith of his family and what this did to him. He was seeing his parents were rather, I wouldn't say devout Presbyterians, they were good social Presbyterians, but they certainly believed in God, while Cattell had very definitely given up his belief, but he wouldn't tell his parents. He never let them know about it. I think it would have broken their hearts had they known. But all of these men departed from the religion of their fathers. And they took up on progressivism. They became what is known as the progressive, simply because they believed in the dialectical materialism, in the progressive manner in which man is advancing. That's why they were called progressives. And the reactionaries were those who reacted against it. That's why we call them reactionaries. So the progressives are the ones who believe in this dialectical process, and the reactionaries are those who are trying to stop progress. But and they went into education in a very big way. These educated psychologists believed that socialism was the wave of the future, and that the purpose of public education was to change America from a free enterprise individualist society to a socialist collectivist one. Now, it's interesting that they all believed in evolution, behavioral psychology, socialism, and atheism. And they all decided to apply all of that on the schools. You know, they didn't have to spend their lives wrecking the schools of America, but they all decided to get involved in the schools because that's the only place where behavioral psychology had any practical application. It was a totally useless subject, except perhaps for doing some surveys. And they created the graduate schools of education. What you had basically at this beginning of the progressive period was this marriage between education and psychology. Education and psychology marriage. You have that marriage that takes place there. See, during the Hegelian period, if you wanted to become a teacher, you went to a normal school or to an institute. There was no such thing as a master of education, and there certainly was no such thing as a doctor of education. That was unheard of. But you see, when all of these people came back from Germany with their PhDs, they created these graduate schools of education, the most famous of which was Teachers College at Columbia University. And then each one of the great universities created a department of education, a graduate school of education. Harvard did not give out its first doctor of education until the 1920s. It shows how late a development it was. But what the marriage did, the marriage of education and psychology did, it elevated both subjects to the graduate school level. And you had the creation there of this new elite, the doctors of education and doctors of psychology, working hand in glove together. Well, also a very important man among them was Thorndike, Edward L. Thorndike. E. L. Thorndike. Now, these men were doing all their experiments on animals. Thorndike did his experiment on chickens and decided on the basis of what he learned about chickens that he could transfer that to human beings. He believed that since children were little animals, they could be taught the way chickens learn. And let me read you the quote from, in case you think I'm exaggerating. I have an interesting chapter called Turning Children into Animals. Page 50. It was at Harvard that Thorndike undertook his first work with animal learning, a course of experimentation destined profoundly to influence the American school. Incidentally, what I'm reading to you was written by Lawrence Kremen, who is presently the president of Teachers College, Columbia. And he writes that Thorndike began investigating instinctive and intelligent behavior in chickens, a line of research so novel that he was refused space to experiment at the university and had to undertake his research in the basement of the James House in Cambridge, that is the house of William James, the noted psychologist. A fellowship from Columbia brought Thorndike to New York to study with James McKean Cattell. Cattell was the man who had studied with Wundt. He continued the experiments he had begun at Harvard and in 1898 produced a dissertation on animal intelligence, which stands as a landmark in the history of psychology. What was the nature of the experiment? Basically, they involved an animal in a problem box, a situation in which a specific behavior, like pressing down a lever, was rewarded with escape from the box and a bit of food. The animal was placed in the box, and after a period of random activity, it pressed the lever and received the reward. In subsequent trials, the period between the animals being introduced into the situation and the pressing of the lever decreased to a point at which introduction into the box occasioned a lunge at the lever and the conclusion of the experiment. Thorndike called the process by which the animals tended to repeat ever more efficiently and economically behaviors which were rewarded learning. He called that learning. And out of his experiment came a new theory of learning and a new law founded on that theory. The theory maintained that learning involves the wedding of a specific response to a specific stimulus through a physiological bond in the neural system, so that the stimulus regularly calls forth the response. In Thorndike's words, the bond between S and R is stamped in by being continually rewarded, and from this follows what Thorndike called the law of effect, namely that a satisfactory outcome of any response tends to stamp in its connection with a given situation, and conversely that an unsatisfactory outcome tends to stamp out the bond or connection, etc. While Thorndike was the most influential teacher of educational psychology in America for at least 50 years, 40, 50 years, he influenced everybody in this country. And he drew heavily also on Pavlov, who had done similar experiments. But perhaps the best summing up of Thorndike's view can be found in his own words in his book on animal intelligence, published in 1911. He wrote this: "Nowhere more truly than in his mental capacities is man a part of nature." This is on page 52 of my book. "His instincts, that is, his inborn tendencies to feel and act in certain ways, show throughout marks of kinship with the lower animals, especially with our nearest relatives, physically, the monkeys. His sense powers show no new creation. His intellect we have seen to be a simple, though extended, variation from the general animal sort." This, again, is presaged by the similar variation in the case of the monkeys. "Amongst the minds of animals, that of man leads, not as a demigod from another planet, but as a king from the same race." So in other words, man is just a king of the animals. That's all. And it's interesting how the evolutionists did everything in their power to bring man down to the level of the animals and to begin training him as if he were an animal. Now, all of these men decided that they were going to use the public schools of America to change this society from a capitalist to a socialist. Why? Well, all of these men have always had to deal with man's evil. As psychologists, they also had to deal with it. What is the cause of evil? Well, they decided it was the capitalist system, the competitive capitalist system. And therefore, if you're going to get rid of evil, you're going to have to get rid of capitalism. We're going to have a socialist society. And the schools would have to be used for that purpose. And so they very consciously organized to change the curriculum of the American public school so that the children would become socialist. Dewey, as a matter of fact, in 1898, created his experimental laboratory school at the University of Chicago, where he actually experimented with different curricula to see what would work, what would work. What kind of a curriculum did you need to create little socialists? He decided that, you had to get rid of this Hegelian system, these rows of desks where the pupil related only to the teacher and had no intercourse with the children around him. The child had to become involved in activities. Intellectual pursuits? Academics? Development of intellect? No. You had to develop social skills. And so what they did was they got rid of the desks and the rows, and they put the kids around little tables so that they could begin interacting with one another. What did that do to discipline? Well, in the old schools, children were supposed to keep quiet. You didn't cheat. You didn't relate to your friends or your classmates. You related directly to the teacher. It was a one-on-one relationship between the pupil and the teacher in the old style classroom. The Hegelian classroom had actually inherited very much from the Calvinists. So you had discipline, and you had that teacher and pupil relationship. But now in the new Dewey-type classroom, the kids interrelated among themselves, and the teacher simply walked around and patted kids on the head and said, "That's nice," and was a facilitator or some kind of helper. Another interesting thing they decided. They decided that high literacy was an obstacle to socialism. High literacy, an obstacle to socialism. Why? Well, high literacy produced this independent intelligence, this very high independent intelligence, which was not conducive to socialist control. You see, in a socialist, the progressives wanted to dumb down the masses so that they could be controlled by a new scientific technological elite from the universities and psych labs. Now, how were they going to do this? They wanted to. They decided that high literacy was bad. How are they going to change? How are they going to lower the literacy rate? How are they going to give the impression that they were educating the American people and at the same time lower their level of literacy, to dumb them down? Bit of a problem. But these were very clever men. They were the top psychologists of their day. They were giving PhDs out to everyone else. They decided to change the way you teach children to read. They decided to throw out the alphabetic phonics method of teaching children to read and to put in its place a new method called the whole word or look-say method, the sight method. Now, and this method, this new sight method, would be based on reflex conditioning, on the Pavlovian and the Thorndike methods of teaching that had been developed on the basis of animal learning. And all of this occurred, the change actually occurred in the 1930s, but they began thinking of it much earlier than that. In fact, they began, their conspiracy of against illiteracy began quite early, because it was James McKean Cattell who did the experiments on reaction time with whole words in Wundt's laboratory. And those experiments were used as the psychological rationale for teaching children to read by the whole word method. And Thorndike developed the sight vocabulary technique. He reduced all of English to a number of just essential words. And he complained that children are reading too many words in our schools at too early an age. He said, "That's terrible. You've got to reduce the number of words that they're reading, but have them repeated over and over again." And Dewey provided the social, the philosophy for doing all of this. He said that high literacy was an obstacle to socialism. He provided the psychological, Cattell provided the so-called scientific basis for the new method, and Thorndike provided the methodology itself. Now, two very key men were involved in changing over the teaching of reading in this country. That they were William Scott Gray and Arthur Gates. William Scott Gray had gotten his master's degree at Columbia University under Thorndike, and then went to the University of Chicago. Arthur Gates became Thorndike's protege at Teachers College, Columbia. Gray became the editor of the Dick and Jane book, and Gates became the editor of the Gates Readers, published by the Macmillan Company. And these became the readers that were used in all American schools beginning in the 1930s. Now, I ask you, do you think that these men knew what they were? Do you think that they didn't know what they were doing? Let me read to you, for example, what G. Stanley Hall wrote about literacy. Let me see if I can find that marvelous quote of his. In 1908, Cattell got a young student, a PhD student, to write a book called The Psychology and Pedagogy of Reading. The man's name was Huey. Let me see. I'm trying, my memory escapes me sometimes. Yes. Huey. Edmund Burke Huey. Edmund Burke Huey wrote the book in 1908. Let me get that over here. The reason why I bother to spell out this man's name is because it's the only thing he ever did that he's famous for. He's just a student. He wrote the book which became the authority on the teaching of reading and is still used today by most teachers, most professors of education. Edmund Burke Huey, The Psychology and Pedagogy of Reading. Written in 1908. Back in print. This was, you see, they needed a book. They wanted to push this theory that you could teach children to read English as if it were Chinese. And they wanted to push this theory through the schools of America, through the teachers of America. And how could they do it? By getting some student to write a book about it. Cattell got Huey. Huey was Hall's PhD student, and he wrote the textbook, The Psychology and Pedagogy of Reading, which tells you how wonderful the look-say method is. And when that book was published, Hall wrote a review of it, and he writes on page, it's in 107 of my book, he writes, "Very many men have lived and died and been great, even leaders of their age, without any acquaintance with letters. The knowledge which illiterates acquire is probably, on the whole, more personal, direct, environmental, and probably a much larger proportion of it practical. Moreover, they escape much eye strain and mental excitement. And other things being equal, are probably more active and less sedentary. It is possible, despite the stigma of the pedagogue's age puts upon this disability, for those who are under it not only to lead a useful, happy, virtuous life, but to be really well-educated in many other ways. Illiterates escape certain temptations, such as vacuous and vicious reading. Perhaps we are prone to put too high a value both upon the ability required to attain this art and the discipline involved in doing so, as well as the culture value that comes to the citizen with his average of only 6 grades of schooling by the acquisition of this art. They knew what they were doing. They were destroying literacy, so they had to sell illiteracy. Can you imagine the top educators in America selling illiteracy to the teachers, saying that illiteracy is not a bad idea? Back in 1908. And the interesting thing is, of course, they knew by 1908 that the method produced reading disability. Because Huey, in his book, turned a negative into a positive. He defended inaccurate reading. He writes, quote, "Even if the child substitutes words of his own for some that are on the page, provided that those express the meaning, it is an encouraging sign that the reading has been real, and recognition of details will come as it is needed. The shock that such a statement will give to many a practical teacher of reading is but an accurate measure of the hold that a false ideal has taken of us, viz., that to read is to say just what is upon the page, instead of to think, each in his own way, the meaning that the page suggests." This is on page 100. Well, these were the top educators in America justifying the use of a new method of teaching reading that would produce inaccurate readers and illiteracy. Now, in case you don't know how the method works, let me show you the difference between the look-say method and the alphabetic method. Ours is an alphabetic writing system. The alphabet was invented, 2,000 years before Christ. Before, the first method that human beings used to write was the pictographic method. In other words, cave drawing. A tree looked like a tree, an animal looked like an animal. You didn't have to go to school to know how to read pictography. We even use it today. And you see it all over airports. You know, little pictures nowadays, you know, you look at them and it shows you a spoon, and that means there's a restaurant down there. Or it shows you a picture of a man, that's the men's room. Or it shows you a bag, and that means baggage in that direction. You see them all over the place now. Well, of course, as civilization got more complex, there were an awful lot of words which could not be easily pictured. For example, how would you make a picture of the idea occur? Or early, or low, high, they, throw, speak, common, bring, hear. In other words, there are so many concepts that you couldn't possibly draw pictures of. So what happens is that you create symbols that look like nothing that they represent. They just don't look like anything they represent. And in order to learn them, thousands and thousands of them, somebody had to teach you them. And that was Egyptian hieroglyphics, and is also today's Chinese language, written language, which is ideographic. The Chinese language is composed of about 50,000 words, all of which are represented by symbols. You have to know at least 5,000 Chinese symbols, individual symbols, before you can read Chinese. The Japanese have adapted the Chinese system. What they have done, they've made syllables of the Chinese ideographs. And in order to learn to read in Japan, you have to learn about 1,300 separate little pictures. Well, at around 2,000 years before the birth of Christ, somebody decided that that was an awfully cumbersome way of writing. And it really taxed the memory to have to learn thousands and thousands of little pictures and their meanings. And someone had made the great discovery that all of human language is composed of a small number of irreducible speech sounds. That is, everything we say is composed of a very small number of basic speech sounds. In English, for example, it's only... How many can tell me in English? How many sounds are there in English? Pardon? How many? About 44. There's some debate, but it's about 44. Believe it or not, Everything we say in English is just 44 sounds, constantly rearranged in different combinations. And he said, why not invent a set of symbols to stand for those sounds? A small number of symbols, and matter of fact, we adopted the Latin alphabet, so we use a system of 26 letters to stand for a language that has 44 sounds. And in that way, what we can do is transcribe everything that is spoken into a written form, and then translate what is written back into spoken form. And lo and behold, it was such a tremendous invention, because all you had to learn, all you had to memorize, were 26 letters and 44 sounds, and so a couple of, you know, you have a few little difficulties, but nothing terribly difficult. Certainly a heck of a lot easier than learning a couple of thousand symbols. And so the alphabet was invented, and suddenly what appeared? What was one of the first works that appeared in written form? The Holy Scripture. Now, it's interesting that we had to wait until the alphabet was invented before the Holy Scripture was put on paper that could be read. And remember, what the alphabet does is transcribe the spoken word, the word. What does the Bible say in St. John? In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So the Word is our means. The Word is our means of communication with the Lord. The Word. Not the image. Not the picture. But the Word. And the alphabet permitted a faithful transcription of the Word of God into written form so that it could be brought to men. That's why many people believe that the alphabet was of divine origin. Now, what did the Lukse method do? The Lukse method reverted away from the word back to the image. And John Dewey believed that the image was the way that children should learn, not the word, but the image. Now, when we read alphabetically, take, for example, these two symbols. When we look at that, if you're a Frenchman, you'll say thank. If you're an Italian, you'll say cinque. If you're a German, you'll say fünf. And if you're English, you'll say five. But there's only one way to read this. That stands for the English word five. This stands for not the idea of five. This stands for the English word five. It's the word that refers back to the idea, the spoken word. Once you utter the spoken word, then you know the idea you're dealing with. So this is a two-step process. Alphabetic writing entails a two-step process. Hieroglyphic is a one-step process. Language is used to interpret it. In other words, you can use any language to interpret it. But this is a direct transcription of language. This is interpreted by language. It's a very important difference, because then that means the brain operates in an entirely different way, the two steps. So that, therefore, if you're going to try to teach children to read these words as if they are little pictures, you're going to be in big trouble. Now, to prove to you that this method was based on the conditioned reflex, let me read to you what Professor Walter Dearborn of Harvard University, who was trained by Thorndike, wrote in 1940. He said, the principle which we have used to explain the acquisition of a sight vocabulary, and a sight vocabulary is teaching children to look at English words as if they were little pictures, by sight, without knowing the letters of the alphabet. It says, the principle which we have used to explain the acquisition of a sight vocabulary is, of course, the one suggested by Pavlov's well-known experiments on the conditioned response. This is as it should be. The basic process involved in conditioning and in learning to read is the same. In other words, what Dearborn is telling us is that we teach children to read in American schools as if they were dogs, Pavlov dogs, animals. We use the stimulus response technique, the conditioning technique. Because if you're going to teach children to read your alphabetic words as if they were pictures, how many of them are they going to be able to memorize as pictures? Not very many. Matter of fact, that's the big problem. That's why you have so much reading disability. They can't remember all of these words. You have to have a photographic memory. And there are very few children can learn to read that way. Now, Dearborn and Thorndike and the others didn't think that there was much difference between a child and a dog. I submit there's a bit of a difference. A teeny bit of a difference. For example, a young child comes to school at the age of 6 with a speaking vocabulary of between 5,000 and 35,000 words. So that child at age 1.5 to 2 begins teaching himself his own language, so that by the time he gets to school at the age of 6, he has a verbal and auditory mastery which is amazing. And here he comes to school, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, with a speaking vocabulary of 5,000, 10,000 words, all self-taught, without the help of Sesame Street. All self-taught, because man is a verbal, is a speaking creature. So he comes to school. And if he went to school in the 1940s and 50s when they were using Dick and Jane in the classroom, he was given this to read in the first grade. And perhaps some of you have had Dick and Jane. This is on page 114. It'll be a bit of nostalgia for you. He's taught to read, "Dick, look, Jane, look, look. See Dick, see, see, oh, see, see Dick. Oh, see Dick. Oh, 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 funny, funny Dick." Now, this youngster, he hears this, and he says to himself, "Either I'm crazy or she's crazy." Because he knows full well that people don't talk this way. He's taught himself to speak. He's got a vocabulary of over 5,000 words. He's no fool. He's very, very intelligent. Self-taught. And so he says to himself, "Well, school must be very peculiar, very strange place, weird. But, mother says I should go, and teacher says I should read this, and so maybe there's something about it that I don't know." But by the end of the first year, teacher tells mother, "Johnny has a reading problem. And he's going to have to be kept back a year." And then by the end of the second year, mother is told, "Johnny has a reading disability. And he's not doing very well." And by the end of the third year, his mother is told, "Johnny is dyslexic. In fact, he may even have minimal brain damage. In fact, Johnny is not smart at all. He's dumb. Dumb, dumb, dumb." And so here's this youngster who came to school having taught himself to speak his own language, now finds out that he's hopelessly stupid because he can't learn to read. Meanwhile, he's got all this energy, this learning energy, but nothing's happening with it, so he begins creating havoc in the classroom. He's jumping all over the place, and they're telling him, "Johnny is hyperactive. And if you want to keep him in school, we're going to have to drug him." So then they give Johnny some drugs. And by the time he's in the fourth grade, Johnny is a little zombie. Now, what I am telling you has happened to millions of American students all throughout the schools of America. All planned by these great psychologists who decided to change the way reading is taught in the school, to dumb down the nation and to create reading disability and reading loss. So they tell his mother that Johnny is reading, that he's learning disabled. How could a child who's taught himself his own language be considered learning disabled? He's very learning able. He's been subjected to teaching disability. You see, now there are many good teachers, many fine Christian teachers who teach, look, say, in the classroom. They don't know they're doing it because they've been told by their professors to do it. And they're doing the best they can to teach Johnny to read with Dick and Jane or some of the other similar types of books. And they're not aware, they don't know why Johnny can't learn, and so they believe their teacher that there was nothing wrong with the children. It was the method that was being used to teach them. Now, to prove to you that the professors knew exactly what they were doing, let me show you what was done when they had to revise these books in 1951, Dick and Jane. In 1930, the Dick and Jane pre-primer, let me write these down so you can see them very clearly. Here's the 1931 edition of Dick and Jane. They taught 68 sight words. Sight words. 39 pages of text. One illustration per page, so we'll put 39 illustrations. 565. In other words, they repeated these 68 words 565 times. And then the teacher's guidebook, was 87 pages. In 1950, in 1951, they increased the number of pages, 172 pages, divided up into three separate pre-primers, 184 illustrations, total words 2,613 words. The guidebook had been expanded to 182 pages, and guess how many sight words they were going to teach? 58. 10 words less in 1950, and yet they had to expand that. They had to use 172 pages to teach 58 words, 184 illustrations to teach 58 words. 58 words repeated 2,613 times, and a teacher's guidebook. The teacher needed 182 pages of a guidebook to teach 58 words. In 1930, the word look, this is in 1930, the word look was repeated 8 times. In 1951, 110. In 1930, the word O was repeated 12 times. In 1951, 138 times. In 1930, the word C was repeated 27 times. And in 1951, 176 times. So you can see very clearly that they knew it was a total and utter failure. Total, complete waste of the taxpayers' money. Totally damaging to the children's minds, to their reading ability. And yet that's what they did. So that's what you would call dedication on the part of these professors to do their destructiveness. Now, so the first two periods of American education were characterized by high literacy. This period is now low literacy. And now you know why we have low literacy. The method. Is this method used today? Of course it is. It's still in 85%. 85% of our children are taught by this method. It's no longer called look-say. It's now called psycholinguistics. Psycholinguistics is the new terminology for look-say. You see, because after Rudolf Flesch, the professors decided to change the terminology because too many parents found out what look-say meant. So they changed to psycholinguistics. The professors were absolutely enraged by Rudolf Flesch because he made them appear stupid. He said in his book, look, phonics works better than look-say. And he provided the research evidence to prove it. And he was telling these professors, he was telling them, look, you guys, phonics works better than look-say. Well, he wasn't telling them anything they didn't know. But he made them appear ridiculous and stupid in the public science, so they were furious. They were infuriated by him. And so what did they do? They turned the entire teaching profession against Rudolf Flesch. They turned all the teachers against him, told the teachers that he's no good. And then they proceeded to create the International Reading Association. Let me put that down here. International Reading Association, which is the largest professional organization for reading teachers and elementary teachers in America. Their headquarters are in Newark, Delaware, near the University of Delaware. They have three major professional publications. They hold a conference, a convention every year, and they constantly downgrade phonics and play up psycholinguistics. International Reading Association. They control the teaching of reading in this country. I defy anyone in this class to try to get phonics mandated as the only way of teaching reading in the first grade in any school in America, any public school. See how far you'd get. There isn't a legislature in America that can do it. The hold of these people is now so strong on the teaching of reading in this country. And they are destroying literacy in America. Of course, since we don't have a dictatorship, children have learned in other ways. There's been some of them who knew how to read before they got to school, so they weren't destroyed. But at least one-third of American children have been so terribly damaged and crippled by look-say that you can call them functionally illiterate. And that's why we have this abnormal problem of functional illiteracy, and nobody knows what to do about it. They just don't know how it all happened. They're so helpless. Just give them more money. That's all. That's all they ask for. The NEA and the educators, you know. Give us more money. We need more money. More teachers. But the federal government has pumped $42 billion into compensatory education through Chapter 1, and the SAT scores have gone down. So we know that it has nothing to do with money. It has to do with the philosophy. Now, it's interesting that during this period, around 1917, the progressives took over the NEA. And they turned the NEA into a large membership organization. And the reason why they turned that into a membership organization is because if they wanted to implement their program in the schools of America, if they wanted to change this country into a socialist society, they would have to have the cooperation of the teachers. And so the NEA was used as the vehicle by which teachers would be influenced and controlled and manipulated. The NEA Journal, for example, did a tremendous job of building up these two gentlemen. You read the articles that these two gentlemen wrote in the NEA Journal, calling them America's top teachers of reading, greatest professors, their knowledge of reading, etc., etc. I've read through every issue of the NEA Journal, and I can attest to you, and I quote them in my book, that the NEA played a very, very important role in bringing the new method into the schools of America and giving it the imprimatur of authority. and of psychology and of all of that. So what we have here is really a giant conspiracy of the progressives determined to use the American school to change the society. Now, it's interesting. I told you that in the first period of our history, you would say that the purpose of man's life was to glorify God, and that was also the purpose of his education. In the second period, it was to glorify man and the instrument of his power, the state. Now, what was the purpose of man's life in the third period under the progressive? It was to deny God, to denigrate God, to blaspheme God, and to sacrifice the individual on the altar of collectivism. Sacrifice on the altar of collectivism. A very different purpose. You can see how the three periods in American history have a very distinct, different purpose. How far we've gone from the glorification of God to the denials, the denigration, and the blasphemy of God. That is what the progressives, that's their goal, to separate man from God. And of course, we see that every day in our schools in America, the separation of man from God. The latest, of course, was in Iowa, where the court there handed down a ruling outlawing a benediction at graduation ceremony. Very soon after that, the court handed down another ruling forbidding the Gideon Society from giving out Bibles to children in the schools. And, of course, the Supreme Court handed down a ruling in Alabama outlawing that minute of silent prayer. They said you could have a minute of silence as long as there's no prayer. What do you do with a minute of silence without prayer? Well, that's the kind of thing we're getting. They are stripping religion out. They're getting every possible vestige of religion out of the schools entirely. And, of course, you have your humanist manifestos written, let's say, the first one in 1932 and the second in the 1970s. I have them in my book, The Humanist Curriculum. Yes, the 1933, the Humanist Manifesto, which was the stated philosophy of these people. Humanist Manifesto. And then the second Humanist Manifesto 2, those are 1973 is the second one. And they very explicitly tell you their philosophy. I mean, there are no secrets. This is a conspiracy, but it's a very open one. Very little of it is secret. I've been able to get everything from the published record. I haven't had to hide behind any doors and listen to any secret conversations. It's all in books, in the record. It takes a little digging, a little time to ferret it out, but it's all there. They've been very candid with one another. They told each other what they wanted to do, what they were about to do. And so we, at this point, we are quite well along in the conspiracy. Because the humanism now in the schools includes far more than just low literacy. You've got such choice subjects like death education. How many people here have heard of death education? Well, I see you're a knowledgeable audience. But that death education is responsible for the rise of suicide. There's a direct correlation. There certainly is a statistical relationship between the two. And yet, have you noticed any call? Have you heard of any call for an investigation of death education? They've had now Luke say in the school since 1930, and they still don't know what's causing the reading problem. The educators, they'll tell you, oh, we just don't know. It's a mystery. Of course the public knows, but they won't admit it. And if it's, here we go, and Flesch wrote his book in 1955, and this is 1985. 30 years we've known what the cause was. It was publicly known, and yet nothing has changed. You think they're going to throw out death education? Matter of fact, when I was in Indianapolis the other day, I visited the Indiana State Education Association, Teachers Association, and there they had on the shelves a group of books that the NEA puts out called Education in the 80s, and they have one for each particular subject matter. And the one on health education had a chapter on death education entitled Death Education Comes of Age. I didn't even know it had existed. Now it's coming of age. By Kathleen Hoyt Middleton. And she writes this. In the 1980s, the subject of death and dying will become an accepted and essential aspect of the health education curriculum. Journals such as Death Education and Omega can be helpful in keeping up to date on the issues. Did you know there was a journal called Death Education? I've never seen it. Funeral directors in many communities are also becoming concerned with their role as educators. I didn't know the funeral directors were being recruited by the NEA as educators. This is the kind of thing that's going on in the United States. Most parents don't even know it's happening. But I had one girl came up to me after I went through this whole business of death education and the speech, and she came up to me at the end of the lecture. She said that when she was a senior in high school 10 years ago, her teacher asked the entire class to write out plans for their funerals. She had to, you know, say what kind of music she wanted to play, who she would invite to her funeral, what kind of a eulogy she'd like spoken at it. There's a funeral parlors. That's a part of death education. The children are taken to funeral homes. And one mother told me that her daughter had actually witnessed the undertaker embalming a corpse. And I've heard of children trying out coffins in the undertaking establishments. Well, that's the kind of thing that's going on. No, but who mandated death education? Has there been any clamor on the part of American parents or teachers to suddenly get involved in the subject? No, it's obvious that they are now. The intensity of the brainwashing on the children of America is frightening. You have the death education, the sex education, the values clarification, the pornography, the paganism, it's incredible. I've read some of the new master plans of education for some of the states, and I can tell you they are frightening. They are humanism from beginning to end. Frightening. I saw the one from West Virginia the other day. I was given it. Nice big fat book, Master Plan for Public Education in West Virginia. I read the one from North Carolina. You have one from Rhode Island? I'll bet that's a Lulu. But they're all the same, and they're all being pushed by the same people who control the whole system, the progressives, the behavioral psychologists. You see, these graduate schools of education have now become the controllers of the entire education system. That marriage between education and psychology has given them a grip on our public school systems which cannot be broken. That's why reform is impossible. That's why Christians who believe that they can reform public education are really whistling in Dixie, as they say. It can't happen, because what are you going to do with those graduate schools and all those doctors of psychology and doctors of education? They've got tenure. They've got money. They're behind the scenes. They're invisible, you see. The only people who are visible are the schoolroom teachers, and they're taking all the flack. These poor teachers, many of whom are very good Christians. I've met many of them. But they're getting all the flack. And the professors in the background who are doing all the damage, planning everything, they are totally invulnerable. So what is the solution to all of this problem? if you cannot reform public education, then the only hope for Christians is to withdraw from it. I cannot see any possible other alternative to save as many children as possible. Now, it's interesting. Let me read to you some of what I write about this particular situation. In the speech that I've been giving going around the country, I talk quite deeply about the moral disintegration within public education. And I highlight the deaf education because it's such a strange and weird thing. And it's causing so much havoc. You know, 6,000 young people killed themselves last year in America. And it's causing untold tragedy. And I describe this whole literacy business. And then I ask this question, I ask the audience this, I say, after hearing all of this, you must be wondering what kind of men would deliberately devise a plot of such diabolical evil to destroy the minds and souls of our youth. They destroy the souls by telling them that they're animals, you know, that they have no souls, there is no God, so they have nothing to live for, really. And then I add, I believe that Dewey, Cattell, Judd, Thorndike, and the rest were basically Satanists, driven by a hatred of God so deep that they were willing to spend their lives doing everything in their power to turn the American people against them. And as I described to you, they came from good Christian homes, but then they've spent all of their professional lives doing everything in their power to destroy Christianity and the word of Christ and the work of Jesus Christ and to substitute in its place a new religion called secular humanism. And when you spend all of your professional life trying to destroy the work of Jesus Christ, I believe that you are a Satanist. I believe that that's the only thing you can be called. And that is why today's educators are creating so strong a fight against school prayer, creationism, or even equal access. And you see it all around you. They will not give Christians, they won't even give Christians their minute of silent prayer. Big deal, a minute of silent prayer. You know, in a way, I'm glad they won't give Christians that minute, because if they did, Christians would shout hallelujah and go back to sleep. And what good is a minute of silent prayer when you're going to give 5 hours and 59 minutes to the devil? But unfortunately, Christians are not very smart. I mean, in Iowa, they took prayer out of the graduation ceremonies. They'd take their Gideon Bibles away. Have you heard any outcry from Christians in Iowa? I'm still listening. Haven't heard a word. Christians take everything. The humanists have had no resistance. That's why they're not going to give Christians a minute of silent prayer. Why should they? They don't have to. They don't have to give Christians anything. And the Christians take it all. You would think that the Christians of Iowa would have said, enough's enough, we're taking our kids out of these schools. We don't need these government schools. We're going to create schools of our own where we could give them the Bible. And we can give them religion in every subject, not just 1 minute of silent prayer, but we can put it in history and in geography and in mathematics and everywhere, because religion belongs in every subject. Christ belongs in every subject. But then I go on and I tell my that the teachers in America, the program of the progressives is to turn this nation against God. And the American educator has played a central role in turning the American public school into a temple of atheism, ignorance, and vice. Now, humanism, socialism, and communism have one thing in common. They all share a burning hatred of God. And I think I made that quite clear by showing you how the humanists and the socialists and the communists really are all part of the same satanic bunch. This makes them allies in their determination to wipe out Judaism and Christianity. Hatred of God makes them all Satanists, for Satan's mission is to separate man from God by any means he can devise. That's what Satan wants, to separate man from God. Once you separate him from God, he's vulnerable. Igor Shafarovich, the brilliant Soviet mathematician, writes in his book, The Socialist Phenomenon, quote, "The death of mankind is not only a conceivable result of the triumph of socialism, it constitutes the goal of socialism." Now, Shafarovich has lived all of his life in the belly of the monster under communism. His book was smuggled out of Russia and printed in the United States with an introduction by Solzhenitsyn. And he says, the death of mankind is the goal of socialism. The complete extinction of mankind is not a chance external consequence of the embodiment of the socialist ideal. This impulse is a fundamental and organic part of socialist ideology. To a greater or lesser degree, it is consciously perceived as such by its partisans and even serves them as inspiration. Now, that's a very profound insight, because haven't you often wondered why there are so many people in this world willing to die for Satan? Willing to die to bring the gulag to America, willing to die to bring hell on earth. They're doing it in Nicaragua, in Cuba, Africa, all over the place. That's why the human race has lived under tyranny for so long, because there were so many people willing to die for Satan and so few people willing to die for Christ. That's the story of the human race. We've reached a point now where things are really getting bad. There was that brief period in our history when Calvinism triumphed and brought us freedom. And in that small period of time, civilization triumphed. Man suddenly began to invent, to do all kinds of things. The idea of free enterprise prevailed. But that's a very short period in history. Throughout history, the Satanists seem to have controlled things. In other words, socialism, communism, and humanism are cults of racial suicide. No wonder so much talk of nuclear holocaust by the humanists and communists. Have you noticed, even in the schools, how the human race is on the brink of self-annihilation? Where did that idea come from? From the communists. Human race is ready to go up in smoke. No wonder Jim Jones staged a mass suicide of himself and his followers. I don't know how many of you remember that, Jim Jones. Well, that's communism in microcosm. Line up everybody, take cyanide, and then the leaders go last. No wonder Pol Pot killed off half the Cambodian nation in 1 year. Remember Jane Fonda, how she told us how wonderful it would be if the communists won? So they won in Cambodia, and what did they do? They proceeded to kill off their own people. Wiped out half the nation in 1 or 2 years. And no wonder the humanists are pushing death education in the schools of America. See, they want to give Americans a head start. 6,000 suicides last year. So, you know, that's head start. You've heard of head start and follow through. So that's their version of it. As a matter of fact, in Brown University, right across the bridge there, the students there petitioned the health department to stock cyanide tablets so that they could all commit suicide in case of an impending nuclear attack. It just shows you how suicidal this nation is getting. And no wonder we have killed over 15 million unborn babies. That's a form of national suicide, is it not, when you're killing off half your younger generation? And we don't know what we've lost. We don't know how many geniuses were lost in that holocaust, how many great men and women. But we'll pay a price for that, you can be sure. Now, where does this suicidal impulse come from? I believe it comes from Satan. I believe the suicide of mankind is Satan's ultimate goal, because it would represent man's complete and utter rejection of God and his gift of life. And why do men follow Satan? Because he permits them to exercise their sinful natures and promises them fulfillment of monstrous lusts, which lead to unrestrained human degradation. Degradation is the unmistakable hallmark of Satan's work, for Satan loves to degrade God's masterpiece made in his image. It is the rejection of God that makes us all susceptible to Satan. And that is why Satan encourages skepticism, agnosticism, and atheism, anything that will separate us from God and remove us from God's protection. Satan is the father of lies, and whenever falsehood begins to dominate an institution, you can be sure that it has fallen under satanic influence. That is now true of public education, where educators routinely lie to deceive the public. There are few institutions in America as dominated by the lie as public education, and that is a sure sign of satanic control. So that's where we are today. Our public schools are under total satanic control today. Now I ask you, is it possible to work within the system? Is it possible to get anywhere within such a system? Of course, you might say all of American society today, for the most part, is under satanic control. But we have to resist. The most important thing is to save the children. And how do you save the children? You get them out of the satanic schools and put them in good church schools and good home schools. Now, obviously, the Satanists, of course, want racial suicide. They want the entire human race to be wiped out. Why? Well, if we're not here, if Satan can get us all to commit suicide, then we'll be his in hell forever. And he will have accomplished what he wants to do to prevent Christ's coming here. You know, so he'll say, well, Christ will come, but there'll be nobody there to greet him. But of course, Christ is going to win. Christ is victorious. We can be assured of Christ's victory. But the thing is this, how much suffering is going to take place? What can we do to alleviate the suffering? We've already permitted so much suffering to occur, and the millions of children who live crippled lives because of what's happened in schools. So the thing is for Christians to become the awakened people in the community, to sound the alarm, to begin letting others know what's happening to the children of this country, that they are being destroyed by the Satanists who want their souls, their bodies and souls. And they are now intensifying their campaign to get the children. It's really reaching a point where, of course, we're in a titanic spiritual struggle between Satan and God. You have to choose sides now. No in between. And God is not asleep. You know, when God made his covenant with Noah and said he would never bring flood, he said he wouldn't bring AIDS. No, he said that he would. He didn't say that he wouldn't bring AIDS. AIDS is the new plague. And according to People magazine, it's doubling. The victims are doubling every year. We're now up to 11,000 a year. Next year it'll be, and by 1992 it'll be a million. And the schools are pushing sexual promiscuity. The schools have not told the children to stop. As a matter of fact, what they're telling the children is there are safe ways to do unsafe things. That's what they're telling the children. I have that quote from, there are safer ways to do unsafe things from their book on health education, the NEH book on health education. And the rock music is contributing to it also, you know. The video music. The death cults, the satanic cults that are rising all over this country. So the battle is increasing in its fever and its pitch. It's up to us to do something about it. The most that I can do is bring you this information. I hope that you will make the most of it. You can see where we've gone. Our great nation started by these fantastic Calvinists. And where we are today, betrayed by so many of these men who gave up their belief in God and became the minions of Satan. Thank you very much.
John Sandbach of School that John Dewey went to Russia in 1921 to 1930 and participated in setting up their educational system. Was that true?
Did John Dewey go to Russia and participate in setting up their education system? Yes, he did. And it's in my book. I do take up his visits to Russia. Many of the progressives went to Russia. And I have a chapter called the entitled The Soviet Connection, where I show the connection between the psychologists and the American psychologists and the Soviet psychologists working together. Yes?
Did you say there is any tie in this? Some of the latest theories going around in America right now, you should not teach children that are age 9 or 10 based on the nervous system. Do you see any connection with that, or is that purely a scientific type?
Do I see any tie-in between the theory that you should not teach children up before the age of 9 or 10 because of some neural development? I don't think so, because the progressives want the children in the schools even earlier now. They want to get them in the schools at 3 years old. As a matter of fact, they want to lower the compulsory school attendance laws down to 4-year-olds and then probably the 3-year-olds. And certainly a child who can teach himself to speak his own language at beginning of a year and a half is certainly in a position to learn. I mean, there's nothing wrong with his neural system. Some children have a slightly more difficult problem handling symbols, visual symbols, and so you take a little longer, you persevere a little harder, that's all. No. Once they have a good speaking vocabulary, that's it. That's an indication they're ready to learn to read. Yes. What's the response been from the NEA on my book? Well, they've said that my book defies rational response. So they've been very irrational about it. What effect is there on children that without Sunday school? Well, they even have less religion than Christian children. What's really pitiful these days is what's happening to the black children in our schools, because they're coming from homes that are really shattered, and their literacy rate is so bad. In 1930, the illiteracy rate among urban blacks was 9.2%. That means that in 1930, over 90% of the black urban blacks were literate, which means when you were literate in 1930, you could read anything. And that was at a time when they had Jim Crow and racial segregation and prejudice and all of that. And yet, in 1985, the illiteracy rate is now 50% among blacks. And this is with affirmative action, with billions of federal dollars, with equal educational opportunity and all of that. So you can see that it has nothing to do with money. It's a methodology. Mm-hmm. Didn't the NEA approve teacher competency testing? They recently came out and decided that beginning teachers would be tested. That is, only beginning teachers. Because they said, well, lawyers are tested, they have to take bar exams, and doctors undergo testing, and many other professions require testing. So they've condescended and decided that teachers should also be tested. We've been told that the Humanist magazine has announced that it is going to sue the United States government because of the Hatch Amendment. In case you're unfamiliar with the Hatch Amendment, it requires teachers to get the consent of parents if they are going to give children such things as death education or values clarification or certain kinds of psychological testing. And of course, this throws a monkey wrench in the whole humanist program, because they've been doing this without parents even knowing that it's going on. This is to them a tremendous threat to their program, and now they're going to sue the United States government. Now, the point they're going to make, because I've heard this point already made, is that parents are trying to censor the schools. They're going to accuse conservative and religious parents as being censors and book burners, you know, that kind of thing, because we don't want or being against academic freedom. That's probably the tack they're going to take. Yes? In the light of my research, what is the analysis of my own education system? Well, I was taught to read and write. I'm grateful to the schools for that. I went to public schools in the 30s and the 40s in New York City, and I had at least learned to read and write, though I learned nothing about capitalism, nothing about free enterprise. I did fairly okay in history, but it was in college where the damage was really done. When I got to City College, that's where they almost turned me into a socialist. I didn't become a socialist, but I accepted it as inevitable. I'd come to the conclusion that it was inevitable because I guess they'd been drumming it into our heads day in and day out that socialism is inevitable. But and they also turned me into an atheist because in college I studied comparative religion. And having been born a Jew, I could not, you know, say, well, why should our people be the chosen people? You know, that's being terribly undemocratic. You know, after all, there are all these Rosicrucians and other types of religions that we studied, and what makes one religion better than another. In other words, I came to the conclusion that all religions are equally false. You know, there is no truth. That's what you learn in comparative religion. They teach you to be democratic about religion, that there is no true religion, because you've got to be tolerant of everybody else's views. And so it takes quite a bit by the time you get back to understanding that there is the truth. Christ is truth. And of course, if you say this at the Phil Donahue show, you're accused of being a horrible bigot because you know, like all these people are saying, you mean that I can't go to heaven? You know, I'm not allowed in your heaven, as if human beings determine who goes to heaven. It's not up to any of us determining who goes to heaven. It's up to God. But they all take it as some kind of personal affront if they find out that according to your religion, they won't go to heaven. You know, they want to be able to sin and go to heaven. They want their cake and they want to eat it too. But it takes guts today to stand up for the truth. And courage. You don't have to be, obnoxious about it. What I would like to see as the outcome of my work is really the abandonment of government schools. The abandonment of government education, because you cannot give true religious education in a government setting. It will always stand in the way. It will always be a hamper. And the government schools cost too much. They're too easily corrupted and controlled by the wrong people. I would prefer, for example, I have no objection to atheists having their own schools. But I do object to Christians supporting atheist schools. Because our public schools today are atheist schools. And only atheists in this country are entitled to public funding. What makes them so privileged? They really are a very small minority in our population. And yet, every American is forced to support atheist education. They get a free ride. They don't pay for Christian education, so why should Christians pay for atheist education? But as long as we cling to this public school, and as long as Christians put their children in public schools, we don't have a moral leg to stand on. What we have to do is really, Christians have to separate themselves from the government schools. They've got to finally decide they have no choice in the matter. They've got to get out of it, create their own institution so that the children can be well educated in the way of God. And let whoever wants those public schools have them. But at the same time, though, Christians should form a movement to remove their support from the public schools. Go to court. I mean, why is it that the humanists go to court at the drop of a hat? For example, in that Iowa case, one Unitarian parent went to court because he did not want his daughter to have to sit through a minute of prayer at the last day of school. Now, she could have plugged her ears for that 1 minute of prayer. Instead, he went to court with the help of the Iowa Civil Liberties Union to get a prayer out of all the graduations in all of Iowa. That's what the Unitarians will do. When are Christians going to do something like that? I'm waiting. interesting thing about that whole property tax business. You know that these atheist schools have a lien on all your property? You think you own your property. You've got a little piece of paper, says a deed, you own your property. You're just a renter. You're renting it from the government. You may have built it, you may have paid for it, but the government owns it. Because anytime you don't pay your rent, which is your tax, they can throw you off, throw you out. As a matter of fact, a widow, an 80-year-old widow, could have lived in that house for 60 years. Own it, paid for it, everything. But if she doesn't pay that rent, she's out. That's not private property. That's government property. That's another evil that government education has done to us. You see, the goal of the communists is the confiscation of all private property. They're almost there. They're almost there. They're so close to their total goal that it's amazing that the people have not woken up yet. They have kept us mesmerized and asleep, you know, etherized, like under an operation table. They're doing their job on us. Well, we're out. You know, well, it's time to wake up.